Hello and welcome to Way Too Twog's Bagpipe and History Podcast, where I, your host, Jeremy Kingsbury, explores the likely repertoire of 18th and early 19th century bagpipers. Let's enjoy some music. So this is a slightly different episode than I intended to make. This is going to be an audiobook episode. I tried two different attempts at figuring out a way to include an audiobook from Robert Bremner as part of my kind of music theory episode, because Robert Bremner's short treatise on the rudiments of music is really the thing that kind of broke me and got me to understand the importance and the value of key signatures. And I kept on referencing it so often, I think it just makes sense to listen here. Now, I've used this tune before. In fact, I have a tune from this book in my first album, Oyster Wives Rant. The tune Aberdeen, or St. Paul's Hymn, is on that album, and you'll hear that on the next episode. But what I always liked about this preface, as you'll hear, is Robert Bremner complaining about how little effort or how detached the average Scottish congregation or churchgoer in the 18th century, in the mid-18th century, this comes out in the 1760s, how much they didn't adhere to music theory. Bremner was tasked in the 1760s with kind of continuing the good work that was being done in the Monymusk Revival in terms of music, where people were starting to sing accompanied by pitch pipes, so they were in the same pitch, and there was some kind of consistency. Some bigwigs in Scotland in the church scene, in the kirk scene, wanted that to go wide, and so Bremner went around kind of listening to how music was happening in the various kirks in Scotland, and then trying to create a standardized way so everybody would make music the same way. And his whole preface is complaining about how much people aren't doing that. And so I love that as an example of how people in 1760s Scotland, at least, didn't adhere to the musical theoretical frameworks and rules that Robert Bremner thought were important as a more classically trained musician. Like, we see, to me, this was evidence of like a real folk tradition and musical tradition that was sort of outside the bounds of the more controlled and maybe limiting Western music theory that Bremner was championing. But there's a really interesting detail in here where he lists some tunes and talks about how make sure that the melody matches the feeling of the lyrics, and so this tune should be somber or that tune. If the songs are somber, they should be this type of melody, and if they're chipper, they should be a different type of melody. And it was just really useful for kind of looking and realizing, oh, when I play that tune, it doesn't sound like Bremner says it should feel. I must not be quite playing that right. And that's sort of what all of a sudden triggered a desire in me, or whatever it took finally, to like pay attention to key signatures and how a tune was supposed to sound and kind of feel. So anyway, I'm going to let Bremner speak for himself. This is the preface of his 1762 book, The Rudiments of Music, or a short and easy treatise on that subject, to which is annexed a collection of the best church tunes, canons, and anthems. And then I'll go straight from the audiobook, and I promised you I would let you hear my existential dread over realizing I had reached a new level of understanding music theory. So you hear a little bit of clip of that, and then I'll come in and play some tunes. Following is a reading from The Rudiments of Music, or a short and easy treatise on that subject, to which is annexed a collection of the best church tunes, canons, and anthems. The second edition, with considerable additions, particularly instructions for song and a plan for teaching a crowd, by Robert Bremner, Edinburgh, 1762. Printed by the author and sold at his music shop at the Harp and Holboy. The author's most humble address to those in power. My anxiety for the success of music, especially as it is employed in praising the Creator of all things, has induced me to leave no method untried to promote an affair of such consequence. And though, in the following treatise, the rock on which it split is pointed out, and a simple method laid down for reviving and conducting it properly, yet this or any other scheme is of no consequence, so long as it is in the power of every organist or church clerk to introduce what tunes he pleases. Were the psalms altered every month, it would be no bar to public worship, there being few that cannot read print, but the loss occasioned by altering the music is irreparable. For though people are taught a few psalm tunes when at school in a most regular manner, yet their knowledge in music reaches no further, and their giving no attention to it afterwards renders them incapable of joining in any new compositions without going to school again, which cannot be expected. It must be allowed that an organist or church clerk with a few trained boys around him may in time teach the tractable part of a congregation the tenor of a church tune, but there will be many whose genius or desire of novelty is so backward that they will not take the trouble to learn anything that they think there is little use for, and should they all endeavor to learn his tenor and also become masters of it, there would be little gain by the acquisition, as it will be next to an impossibility to introduce the other parts by this method. But should an organist or church clerk, even with length of days and indefatigable labor, produce the whole parts and make the congregation sing a suitable number of tunes in the most finished manner, what availeth it? For how soon he dies or leaves the place, his successor, out of a view of gain or to be thought of consequence, despises the former tunes as old and ridiculous and compiles or composes a set of his own. These he holds forth as the finest that have yet appeared, and after procuring the consent of the minister and a few leading people who probably know little of music, but look on him as an infallible judge of those matters, he next introduces them, full of hopes that they will give universal satisfaction, and that the whole congregation will be equally fond of them with himself. But how dismal is the consequence! Those who were in use to praise God skillfully and with a loud voice are at once struck dumb. A beautiful fabric is cast down, and it is 1,000 to 1 if ever the fellow of it be reared again in that corner, for people advanced in life who were probably more than once used in this way are immediately incensed, and apprehending there will be no end to these innovations, they turn obstinate and determine from the time forward either to be silent altogether or to sing according to their own fancy. It is likely that from this arose that common phrase which is to be heard in the mouths of everyone that opposes improvements in church music, vis-a-vis that every man ought to praise God in his own way. To remedy this, it is most humbly suggested that a select number of psalm tunes should be appointed by the legislature for the established churches in Great Britain. Were this the case, What delightful consequences would arise from it. The public would have no fear of being baffled or distracted with novelty, and therefore would judge it as necessary to have their children taught to praise God in a decent and becoming manner, as to read his word, so that harmonious praise would prevail everywhere. The music being universally the same would enable members of different congregations, when met together, to join or with skill and alacrity in that part of worship. The harmony of united parts, when performed regularly by a numerous congregation, strikes the soul with awe and reverence and greatly heightens devotion. The grandeur of the music alone might induce some to go to church who are otherwise indifferent about it. It may be objected that such a law might discourage men of knowledge and genius to attempt finer compositions of this kind than have hitherto appeared. What may happen cannot presently be foreseen. Only it will be evident to any impartial judge that the church tunes composed 200 years ago are nothing inferior to any that have been produced since. If the legislature had not excluded different versions of the Psalms in meter by appointing one for the use of churches, it is more than probable that every church would have their own peculiar set, as they have at present, of church tunes, for the same motives which incite men of genius to the one would equally incite them to the other. This, therefore, being the only part of public worship that is vague and uncontrolled by law, it is most earnestly hoped that these and many other reasons will induce those invested with church government to take an affair of such importance into their serious consideration. To the church clerks or precentors in general, gentlemen, as it is in your power either to frustrate or to assist the intention of the following treatise, the former of which I have no fear of your doing designedly, I beg leave to give a few hints for the better conducting this high act of devotion. And first, let it be your particular care in giving out the psalm tune to begin the note as soft as possible and increase the sound as you go on, or, in other words, to swell the note. And this do at least at the beginning of every line, the consequence of which will be that the whole congregation will endeavor to imitate you, and when they can do it, what a striking effect must a swell of probably 1,000 voices have. On the contrary, if you begin in a bawling manner, how shocking must the bawl of such a multitude be! The next thing recommended is that you introduce no graces, even when they would be agreeable, otherwise they will in like manner copy your example and probably go much further. If the fancy is once set to work, it is uncertain where it will end. It is evident that when these tunes were first composed, they were performed in the churches simply as they are set. For graces of any kind would have destroyed the harmony, but either for want of proper teachers or care in church governors, the parts were in process of time entirely forgot, so that there remained only the tenor. This being the case, few or none at last thought of learning church music, and both the art and excellency of it was so much forgot that when a precentor was wanted, the principal qualifications requisite were poverty and a loud voice for reading the line, it being a matter of no consequence whether he knew a note of music or not. For the tenor, which was the only part attempted, and which was conveyed only by the ear from one generation to another, as now so corrupted by graces and quavers, as they called them, that the tune was entirely defaced, and the original note, which they knew nothing about, had no more share of the performance than the nonsense they thought proper to add to it. Graces are allowable only in solos, or singing alone, and are never introduced in any chorus, whether vocal or instrumental, by the most regular bred musicians. Endeavoring once to convince an old man, who was presenter in a country church, how absurd he rendered the music by allotting so many different sounds to one syllable, when there was only one intended, he replied with a good deal of briskness that he did not value what any man intended, and that he believed the people of the present generation knew nothing of the matter, for his master was allowed to understand that affair thoroughly, and he told him there ought to be 8 quavers in the first note of the Elgin tune. Had the nonsensical graces been the same everywhere, it would have been the less matter, but, on the contrary, every congregation, nay, every individual, had different graces to the same note, which were dragged by many to such an immoderate length that one corner of the church, or the people in one seat, had sung out the line before another half had done, and from the whole there arose such a mass of confusion and discord as quite debased this the noblest part of divine worship. This they called the old way of singing, for which there were many advocates, though in fact it was the new, or rather, no way at all. Many of you will remember that this was the situation of church music in most places of the country until the year 1756, when the improvements in a neighboring county opened the eyes of those in power there, upon which there was a committee appointed consisting of a number of the ministers, lords of session, barons of exchequer, musical society, and the whole town council. The first step this honorable committee took was to appoint a proper number of church tunes, and after they were carefully examined by the best masters, it was appointed to print them, and are the same you have in this little book. They were no sooner published than an universal spirit diffused through all ranks. Men of 70 and boys of 7 years old were at school together, and equally keen of instruction. Their diligence enabled the teachers to produce very fine concerts in a few weeks, there being no piece of education a teacher can surprise the public with so soon as church music. The same emulation ran through our churches, for those that were not taught, being struck with the grandeur of the harmony, were either silent or went alongst with any whose knowledge they could depend on, so that in a few months the former erroneous manner of singing was entirely forgot, and happy had it continued so, but with grief I hear many of you are falling into the same error with your predecessors, and depend upon it, the consequence will be that in a few years church music will be as ridiculous as ever. The graces you are introducing have already prevented many from singing different parts, and when they are once dropped, the whole congregation will, as formerly observed, invent numberless graces of their own, thinking themselves at liberty, by your example, to embellish, or rather confound the music as their fancy directs. I know the argument you use is that in giving out the tune you are allowed to sing some time alone till the congregation know what tune you are singing, and therefore you grace these few notes to make them more agreeable to yourself and the audience, but that after they join, you grace no more. But this very groundless reason, for would you only take the trouble to name the tune you are to sing before you begin, the congregation would strike in at the very first note. If you are the schoolmaster of the parish, which is generally the case in the country, you have all you could wish for as your own scholars, every one of which ought to be taught church music along with other branches of their education, will furnish a band of regular singers upon whose assistance you can always depend, and the order and harmony of their performance will not only be a bar against irregularity, but will also induce others to follow their example. It was observed just now that church music ought to be given along with other education. This, upon consideration, will be found to be the proper time, for when youth are put to school, it is to be supposed they will attend to it for some years, so that if you would only allot for church music 10 minutes every day before school is dismissed at 12 o'clock or in the evening, it would be instruction sufficient for that branch of education. You will probably think it hard to work for nothing. But this will seldom be the case, for those that can pay will, and if you receive no other return than the delight their performance will give, it is enough. For if they are properly trained, it will be the happiest 10 minutes you spend in the day. And to this, that, in process of time, the bulk of the parish will have been your scholars, and consequently, good singers. If the line is not read, which is by far the better way, take care you do not crowd the music too fast on the congregation. When one line is sung, make a proper pause, that they all may be ready to begin the next along with you. The whole beauty and perfection of music depends on keeping time, i.e. to begin and end every note together. If more than 16 lines are sung at once, the congregation will be apt to tire and churn careless both of tune and time. Be careful to choose such tunes that are best adapted to the subject. If the subject is joyful and elevating, the tune you are to sing should be spirited and lively. If it is a mournful and humbling subject, the tune should be grave and solemn. Tunes of the first kind are those with the sharp or greater third, as the stilt, French, Dunfermline, etc. And those of the second kind are characterized by the flat or lesser third, as the Dundee, Elgin, Jedburgh, Bristol, etc. To the reader. As so many authors of note have written upon music, I might justly be charged with presumption should I either attempt to make new discoveries in this science or pretend to offer anything better to the world than has already been published in their writings. My sole aim is to render their superior skill more generally useful by a short and easy treatise on that subject. They wrote for the information and improvement of those who make music their profession, or who choose it for a science which they incline to study in its full extent. I write chiefly for the instruction of those who are yet to learn, and if the few following sheets shall serve to make the first principles of this science so plain and intelligible that any attentive reader of ordinary capacity may understand it, as much of the theory as is necessary for practice, I have gained my end. This desire of being understood even by the people of the lowest rank and education has obliged me to avoid everything that might tend to perplex readers who are at a distance from help, and to write in such a familiar manner as may appear mean to those who are masters of style, but I hope they will excuse me when they consider that things are chiefly to be valued by their tendency to attain the end they are designed for. Though the music master can receive no instruction from this little treatise, yet if he chooses to recommend it to his scholars, it may save him some trouble, as it will inform them of many things necessary for them to know. A number of these tunes are taken from an edition published in the reign of King James VI, when church music appears to have been more regularly performed than it has been among us for many years past. I should have been highly to blame if I had presumed to alter one note of them, except where it evidently appeared to be an error formerly in the press, and not many of these occurred. They have certainly been composed by very great masters, for when the four parts are sung, there is a fullness and grandeur in their harmony which makes them far preferable to most modern compositions of this kind, and I am desired by the best masters and judges in this part of the kingdom, by whom they have been revised, to observe that whoever takes upon to alter a note of them does a real injury to the public, because were they to be altered at the pleasure of every composer, it is more than probable that every town, perhaps every church, would have different sets of the same tunes, so that the members of different congregations, should they happen to meet in one place, instead of harmonious praise, would debase the highest act of divine worship with confusion and discord. The basses are figured for the benefit of those who are learning thorough bass. When the reader peruses the chapter on transposition, I beg that before he proceeds, he may provide himself with a set of the papers there described, and apply them as he goes along. Otherwise, that part of the work will appear useless and unintelligible even to the learned in music. I have nothing further to crave but that the public will receive with indulgence and candor what was certainly well meant and is now humbly submitted to their judgment. A plan for teaching the four parts to any number a house will conveniently hold with as little trouble and as soon as to four people. Having been pretty minute with regard to what related to the scholar, I shall next lay down some rules for you who are teachers of this essential piece of education. Were you all masters of your business, there would be no use for these rules. But this is not the case, there being many dispersed over the country that are obliged to teach it, along with other branches of education, though they know no more of the matter than being taught a few tenors in their infancy, and that in an irregular manner, as it is more than probable their teachers never knew a note of music. But exclusive of these, there are others that assume the teacher, filled with conceit and ignorance, having no other foundation than being applauded by the ignorant for singing a trifling song, or probably a church tune in the character of a precentor, with a better voice than him they heard last. How despicable a figure the pupils of such teachers must make may easily be imagined. Notwithstanding of there being many as above represented, yet with pleasure I know that there are numbers who of late make their business their study. How far the first edition of this book has been a means of their instruction would be vain in me to assert. I shall therefore comfort myself with the hopes that all of you will in due time see the necessity of being properly qualified, and that I have been instrumental thereto will doubtless add to my pleasure. But to the purpose. Let it be supposed you are called or go to a town or village to teach church music. Your first care must be to procure the countenance of the people of fashion. This done, the vulgar will readily follow their example, and you must be much more anxious about their attendance than the better sort, as they are only to be depended on for a good performance at church. For exclusive of their being more numerous, they are very fond of being of consequence, and sing with spirit with a view to keep all around right, whereas if a poor man sing a little out of tune or time, all the gentry next to him are immediately silenced. Your next difficulty will be to persuade the better sort to meet with the commons, but a little reasoning will convince them that it is as reasonable to meet together to learn to praise God in a decent and proper manner as it is to meet to perform that office. Having succeeded so far, let it next be supposed that you meet with your pupils at church, or some large room that will contain them easily, and having seated them all with their books in their hands, desire them to look at the scale, where they will see two staves, each containing 5 lines, the upper comprehending the treble notes, and the lower the bass. Then direct them to look for the first note in the treble scale, which is placed on a little line below the 5, commonly called a ledger line, and this note is called C, or Fa, if you are solfaing. The next note is under the first of the 5 lines, and is called D. The next is E, and is on this first line. The next is F, and is in the space betwixt the first and the second lines, and so on. Having proceeded thus far, desire them next to see the second lesson in the plate of lessons, which is the scale from G to G. Then inform them that as the notes there rise gradually one after another, so they will discover the voice to rise in singing them. Being now ready for the first performance, give a sound for the first note yourself alone, then desire all of them to sing it with you. This done, you will hear many of them here and there wrong. But try it again and again, and you will soon find they will grow better. When they found this note pretty well, inform them you are now to sing 2 notes, and after performing them yourself alone, make them join you as formerly. Here again you will discover several's wrong, particularly in rising to the second, as there are many that can give one sound that cannot without practice move to another. However, always begin again, and the oftener you repeat these sounds, the more exactly they will perform them. After the same manner, make them rise to the third, and by the time you make them sing these first 3 notes frequently over, both forwards and backwards, your hour will be spent, and therefore time to dismiss the pupils, they having got sufficient instruction for the first lesson. If you have not heretofore taught in this manner, you will probably be discouraged when you find many of them have such wretched ears that they know not one sound from another, and therefore conclude it impossible to make any hand of them in this way. But there is no other way you can propose so good. For did you engage with one of these awkwards alone, you could find your labor and lungs spent to no purpose. To evidence this, let it be supposed that you undertake to instruct 1 destitute of genius. Your first attempt will be to sing the scale with him. Very well. You give him a sound, but instead of joining you, he gives a different sound. What is next to be done? You must yield to him and take his sound. So far you agree. You then inform him that you will sing that note with him again, and afterwards rise to the next note. He immediately agrees, but when you rise to the second, he pays no regard to you, but goes on with his first sound, without the least sensibility of the monstrous discord occasioned by the first and second being sung together. On the contrary, if you tell him he does very well, he is very happy. If you then inform him that after he sings the first note, he must make his voice rise higher to sing the second, he again agrees, but when he comes to put it in practice, he only adds loudness to the same sound. And thus he will beat you down and baffle all your efforts. Now, if he is amongst the crowd, they will in time either beat him down or drag him alongst with them, for it is rare if there be not 10 to 1 against him, that is, 10 that have some musical genius for one that has none. You may think from this that it were better to inform such that they cannot learn, and therefore entreat them not to come to school any more, as they confound the performance of the others. This would only be but making bad worse, for though you get rid of them at school, there is no getting rid of them at church, where they are sure to make more noise than those that know the matter. I have heard one of this kind not only confound, but silence all around them, and very justly, for who of any feeling can cross nature so much as to sing in opposition to bawling nonsense? Now, the consequence of allowing them to join your scholars will be that in time they will learn to follow, or if not, they will gradually discover that the sound of their voices differs from the others, and if they once come this length, they are fairly conquered. For they will immediately declare themselves incapable, and from that moment cease to open their mouths, at least so as to disturb the others, but to return with your pupils. Having seated them as formerly, spend some time in refreshing their memories about the notes, and inform them of the names and proportion of notes, as the round note is called a semibreve, and is equal in length to 2 minims, etc. Then turn to the second lesson, which, it is probable, you will make them sing tolerably, both forwards and backwards, before the hour is past. But this depends on what genius the people have for music. It is undeniable fact that the musical genius of the people in some towns is much stronger than that of others. And this may be owing to the having or wanting a town piper, or some such musicanto, to buzz a few little tunes in the children's ears, which tunes they are constantly singing, or endeavoring to sing. I am credibly informed there is a piper in a neighboring town that can only play one tune, and was you to walk through every corner of that town, you would hear that tune, and no other, in the mouth of every child and servant there. Now if the piper and his tune were gone, that town would have no tune at all. And in course, the people's ideas of musical sounds would in a short time be entirely lost. But to return, let it be supposed that you have got them to sing the 8 notes in this lesson tolerably well in tune, only you are distressed with squalling in one place, roaring in another, and distorted faces in a third. In that case, you must set about rectifying these defects immediately, for the sooner a bad habit is removed, the better. Nor is there any time so proper for putting this in practice as when you are singing the scale. All you have to do is to call out to any of that does amiss, then take him off. For example, if he rise his face and overstretches his voice, do you the same, then tell him how ridiculous such a method is, after which let him hear the difference betwixt the false and the natural voice, and how that no voice is disagreeable if it be properly used. A few rebukes of this kind will make the whole afraid of doing amiss, and at the same time delight them, as it is demonstrating the nature and power of the human voice. Having now got their wildness a little curbed, let them hear the beauty of a swelling a note, which is done by beginning the sound very soft, and increasing it in loudness till towards the end, then letting it die away. If they are made to sing every note of this lesson frequently over in this manner, it will very soon rub off all their rusticity and awkwardness. Next, your next business must be to demonstrate the nature of time, after which make them sing the same lesson, giving them 4 motions of the hand to each note, as directed in the former part of this treatise. Then proceed to lesson 3, which is 2 minims and a bar, each of which has 2 motions of the hand, and afterwards to lesson 4, which consists of crotchets, each of which have a motion of the hand. We shall now suppose that these instructions, together with many other things you've found necessary to inform them of in the course of teaching, has taken up a week, and indeed, if you have advanced so far the first week to purpose, you have been very successful. For the most disagreeable part of the work is over, as what follows must give pleasure both to master and scholar. Having met again, your first business must be to go over the former lessons, which is recommended to be done every day, particularly the scale, that is, lesson two, as a just performance of it enables them to perform every other piece in tune, and therefore it cannot be too well riveted in the ear. You may now attempt the tenor of some easy, airy church tune, suppose the French, which is recommended to be sung by neither letters nor solfaing, they being both perplexing and unnecessary, but by any four lines of 8 and 6 syllables from the Psalms or any other poetry you choose. And here it will be proper to observe that in singing church or other music, the syllable must not be closed to the sound to which it is applied is about being done. To illustrate this the better, observe the following line, where literature is made to follow that letter on which the sound ought to dwell. Come now, the timbrel, bring for joy. Coma now, that timbre I bring you for joy. You cannot be too careful about this article. There is nothing more ridiculous than nothing more common than to make the sound follow from the end of some syllables as thy. This monosyllable immediately lands in E, which cannot be pronounced without applying the tongue to the roof of the mouth, by which the sound is greatly diminished. But if it is sung the, it opens the mouth, which you must always endeavor to make them do, so far as the sense and meaning of the word sung will permit. Having got them to sing this tenor tolerably, which, with other things, will probably require a meeting or two, but as this depends on what genius the people have for music, and as formerly observed, I shall from henceforth cease to limit your time, their aptness or dullness being the best dictator in that point. Having, I say, got them to sing this tenor tolerably well, begin another, as St. David's, St. Paul's, St. Anne's, or any other with the sharp or greater third you choose, and by the time they can perform this indifferently, it is to be supposed that they have got a pretty good hold of the former. It is now time to select the voices for the different parts, which is a work that requires caution and judgment. Let it be supposed, then, that your school consists of 200 men, women, and children, 50 of whom you want for basses, 30 for trebles, 15 for counters, and the remainder for the tenor, commonly called the church part. Being provided with a pitch pipe, try the men one by one in this manner. Make him sound the note G in the center of the voice, as the first note of St. Paul's tenor. Afterwards, descend note by note with him till he land on the other G, and observe what power or strength of voice he has there. This done, sound the former or center G again, and ascend with him note by note to the other G, if he can reach so far. Having proved them all in this manner, you have only to allot those that have the most power below for basses, and those that go highest for counters. After the same manner, go over the boys, and if there be not men sufficient to make up your complement of basses and counters, let the boy supply the defect. For though they are at present treble voices, and therefore improper for these parts, yet their being males will sooner or later remove this inconveniency. But you must take care to disperse them amongst your other scholars, for if a number of them are allowed to sit together, they will, during the time of singing a church tune, two or three times over, fall greatly from the pitch, and mar all your performance. If you have, in the course of these trials, found any bad geniuses, be sure to allot them to the bass, as they will do less hurt there than in any other part. Having now disposed of your males, for if there be any over your complement of basses and counters, they are to be tenors, you are next in like manner to go over the females, out of which you are to pick about 30 of the finest and best tuned voices for trebles, and throw all the remainder to the tenor. If in some places you cannot find voices calculated to proportion each part as above, you must therefore be discouraged, but make the best you can of them. Only never allot a man for treble, nor a woman for bass. Having assigned all of them their parts, place the trebles on your right hand, the counters on your left, the basses fronting you, and the tenors behind them. By the bass being thus in the center, the other parts which all arise from it are equally supported, and the disposition they are always to observe and take their seats accordingly. They, being seated, make them all sing over the French tenor, then address the basses, telling them they are now to learn their own part, to which they must be particularly attentive. After going over it several times with them, in like manner, instruct the trebles, and then the counters. And when you find that each posse can keep their own part without your help, then make bass and treble sing together. If they go well, then join bass and counter. And if in like manner these go to your wish, let bass and tenor be joined. Having thus proved all the parts separately, with the bass join any three of them together as bass, counter, and treble, and if this performance is just, try bass, tenor, and treble. If these go well, then join all the four parts. If you have not heretofore heard any such, and if you are not void of all manner of feeling, you will be lost in wonder and admiration at the grandeur of this performance. The first of this kind that was here was at a little chapel, where the teacher brought all his best scholars, to the number of 160, who were not taught together, but in different classes. There were but few met to hear the first performance, but the report these gave of it made numbers flock to the next, some probably with a view to censure, and many out of novelty and pastime. No sooner, however, was the music begun, but a sort of dread and amazement seized every countenance. Some looked pale and ghastly, others were in a chilly sweat, and many stared, and they knew not what. Nay, the teacher himself, a thoroughbred chorister, was not only silenced, but wept excessively. This may seem romantic to many, as they cannot conceive how a simple church tune, in which there is no great art of composition, could produce such effects, but let such consider that it is not the church tune, although music in that style is more solemn, and therefore more striking than any other, it is the number of voices that astonishes. Those who have not heard 160 voices or upwards perform a church tune or any solemn piece of music in all its parts, with proper pauses and fine swells, can be no judges of this matter, it being entirely above their conceptions. Some may be of the opinion that this performance must have been defective without an organ or other instruments to strengthen and enliven the voices, but the want of these was the very cause of its excellency. For their number gave life and strength, and their parts being both short and easy enabled them to perform justly in tune, more justly in tune than any organ is capable of. And to this, that the words sung, which are greatly blunted by instruments, were distinctly heard, without which vocal music is at its best, but dull and insipid. But to return. Having now got the French tune completed, and the church part of another pretty far advanced, go on as formerly instructed, giving them different parts of that tune of which they have learned the tenor, at the same time carrying on another tenor by the whole, for they must all be taught the tenors. And in this manner you are to proceed, by which you will find they will learn a tune in all its parts every week, so that in 12 weeks they will have got 12 tunes, which is number sufficient for any congregation. But if you make them thoroughly masters of these 12 tunes in 6 months, from the time of your first opening school, you do very well, as you have every day, exclusive of their present lesson, to make them rehearse the whole or a part of such tunes as they have already learned, and now and then to give them a new lesson out of the plate of lessons, demonstrating the nature of the different leaps, with many other things, as common as triple time, common and triple time, cliffs, sharps, and flats, etc., so that they may not be ear scholars. On the contrary, if you are at due pains, it is incredible what knowledge they will acquire, even though in a crowd. Nor is this to be wondered at, as they have the same advantages of education with students of some other professions, as divinity, law, or physic. I have often heard the celebrated Geminiani, whose pupil I had the honor to be, maintain that the whole art of composition could be communicated in this manner, and from the instructions I had from him, I discovered no reason to the contrary. The plan for instructing a crowd being now finished, it may not be improper to observe that if it shall happen, you cannot prevail on all your scholars to meet at the same hour and be taught together, in that case you must open a convenient hour for the better sort of people, another for those of middling station, and a third for servants, who all ought to pay according to their stations, though, on the whole, this piece of education should be given very cheap with a view to engage all ranks to learn it. And when they are taught a tune or two in this separate manner, they they must afterwards make a point of having a rehearsal of the whole together at church, or any other convenient place, once a week, which they will soon be equally fond of with yourself. What only remains now to be considered is your conduct at church on the Sabbath day. Having gone there with all your pupils, you must, if possible, have them seated together in some loft or part of the church. If they are dispersed amongst the rest of the congregation, the effect will not only be poor, but it will be rare if they are not put into confusion. Many of them that would do well, do very well with the help of others, may have neither genius nor fortitude to carry on a part alone, and more especially if seated amongst irregular singers. Having them thus placed, and yourself the presenter, or if another, it is to be hoped you have been particularly careful in instructing him, otherwise he will frustrate all your endeavors, you must be careful that they all sing tenor, and no other part during the first 3 or 4 Sabbaths, and you will do well to sing no more than 3 different tunes in that time, which are all sung in the forenoon. As for the afternoon, you may take any 2 of the same 3 you please. There would be no use for this caution if the whole congregation were taught, but as this cannot be expected, the tenor alone must be continued till the ignorant have got a tolerable grip of it, which will soon be the case. And then there will be no danger introducing the other parts. Whereas, if you begin with the whole, the unlearned, upon hearing different parts, will either be silent altogether, or catch any sound that strikes their ear most agreeably, or sing according to their own fancy, and thus all attempts to improve the music will be effectually baffled. Whereas the constant use of one part till it be tolerably well established is both the surest and shortest way to success. And even after the parts are introduced, it will be prudent in the learned to join all in the tenor till it is once sung over, to set the congregation a-going, after which they ought to strike off to their own parts. I feel like it's important to record this as it's happening, but some of the process of reading through Robert Bremner's treatise on the rudiments of music, and I decided to just go ahead and look at the tunes, right? Like, Bremner lists these tunes, like, here's three hymns that are they're like happy and chipper. You should play those for if you're talking about something happy and chipper, and here are some solemn ones in the lesser third. You should play those if you're doing something sad and somber. And, you know, I looked at those and just decided to go ahead and bite the bullet, because I have a pile of whistles now anyway, and just look at what the key signatures were and then play the things as written. And so I know kind of where the starting note is. And it was just, it's so easy. It's so stinking easy. Like, if you can read, if you understand music theory, the temptation to just take what they are writing as gospel, It totally broke it for me. Like, whatever. This is 5 minutes in, but it was just like, yeah, this is no fun. Okay, this is Jeremy in the present now. Yeah, I was pretty desperate and pretty depressed there. I thought about quitting the podcast, but you know, now I'm a couple weeks after that realization, got 3 weeks later now maybe. And, you know, I've seen some real use for it, and I went on to record a lot more kind of meandering, and I say some pretty wrong things about music theory, so it's just not really worth putting here. But if you want to listen to the whole thing, I am planning to upload it as kind of a bonus episode on Patreon at some point soon. Since I'm like a social historian first, I kind of want to talk about that how to teach a crowd thing. There's so many interesting observations about class in Scotland, the idea of the challenge of mixing the lesser sort and an upper sort group of people. And I also just love that Bremner mentions that musical genius of a community is going to be much improved by the presence of a town piper. Again, this idea of whose comes first, you know, that pipers are informing people's musical understanding rather than instructors that Bremner is hoping to train and get to teach everybody. So anyway, that's pretty neat. I also really like that detail that one town piper, the piper only knows one tune, but everybody in that town knows that tune. And if they didn't have that one piper, they wouldn't even know that tune. So anyway, let's get back to the musical theory of it all. The thing that started to like really change it for me was realizing there's so many tunes that I looked through that I didn't care for much, and so I just skipped them and neglected them. And looking at the tunes with, like, understanding how the key signatures work of where the melody is supposed to be and what the tune is supposed to sound like was really helpful for finding some really good music. And there's a couple key signatures that were particularly tricky for me. So things that are in the key of F or in B flat or G minor, those key signatures just didn't really sit well with my approach to kind of experimenting around with tunes. Sometimes I found some really cool ways to make music with sheet music that's like that, and you'll hear that on the next episode, but oftentimes I just threw those tunes out. I'm like, nah, I don't like this tune. But the tune that was like, okay, maybe there's something to this. Maybe it is worth my effort to just quit being weird about this and learn key signatures. That tune was from Robert Bremner's, you know, French. It's French. It's his setting for the tune French or Norwich, which, you know, when I played it, sounded kind of boring and like I would have skipped it, and it didn't match the vibe that Bremner said it was supposed to have. So then I played it as it's written. Here's what I would have done with it when I was just kind of experimenting first. So this is how I would have played French and decided it sucked and moved on. So yeah, not only does it not sound particularly good if I just kind of play it how I think it should be if I was reading normal Illan pipes in G or D major, it also doesn't match how Bremner says it's supposed to sound, right? Like, Bremner says French is one of these kind of happy, joyful tune, and while if there's still some kind of a melody if you play it like I just did, it isn't chipper. But if you look at it again, knowing that it's an F, and the key of F major, and play it on an F whistle, it all of a sudden sounds chipper and bright and really great. So anyway, here is French with all four parts that Bremner, you know, includes. So that's the tenor, the contrast, all four parts, and the bass playing on a low F whistle. Yeah, really good tune. All right, if that was a chipper one, let's listen to one that Bremner said is supposed to be kind of melancholy. And this is one he complains about in the treatise as well, as people adding way too much vibrato to it. So this is Elgin or Carlisle on a C whistle, and then kind of everything building off that. So play it as written, because it's in the key of C major. Thank you. All right, that's an appropriately somber tune. Let's do another chipper one. This one will be Stilt, and it's a fairly easy tune to pick up for me because it's in a key that I already play in, and most of us do. And it is in G major, I think. Yeah, G major is where it goes. So if you play whistles or illan pipes, that is already a key you play in quite a lot. So anyway, here is York, or Stilt, which Bremner says is a happy tune. Alright, so we've been doing a lot of these church tunes, and I feel like I should go out on a hymn tune, so let's take a break for like one quick little interlude here, and just play some more stuff from Bremner. You know, I've played a lot of Robert Bremner. He was really important to season 4, kind of looking into the background of the Bremner family, and he really showed up in a lot of Oysterwise Rant, and I was exploring it a bit, and I realized, I don't know that I've ever mentioned this on the podcast, but the font that, if you ever notice that the podcast uses a weird font, this is as close as I could find to Robert Bremner's title font. It's a font package for Word called Ugly QUA, and it is like spot on to the font that Robert Bremner used in the 18th century. Anyway, I wanted to look at a couple of his dance tunes. He has several country dance books that I really like, and looking at a couple of these tunes, I'm going to play a new one. So we're going to play Jush of Perth, which is a new tune to me, and then Blue Britches, which shows up on Oysterwise Rant, my first album with Oysterwise Rant, actually. But I was thinking about what we mentioned last time about kitchen piping, and the cool thing about Blue Britches is it has that syncopation, like we think of being kind of unique to kitchen piping or Clumsy Lover. I just hadn't really thought about it before, but it's a tune from the 18th century that, again, would sound, I think it wouldn't sound terribly out of place next to some other kind of Neil Dickey and more late 20th century tunes that we would think of as distinctly modern. So anyway, here is Jush of Perth and Blue Britches. These are both from Robert Bremner's collection of Scots Reels or Country Dances. I think this is the one published. The only edition that has survived is after he had already moved his shop to London, but I think it predates that. I think it was printed before the move and he just kept printing it in London. Could be wrong about that, but it's 1750s or 1760s. Might be 1762, might be, yeah, 1762. He's got one country dance book that is like titled, named the dance book of 1757. They often kept the date out because I think they didn't want anybody to think it was old and stale, so you'd have to just keep it going. So Bremner didn't repeat that mistake. So yeah, I think this one is probably from 1760-ish, but could be earlier. Anyway, Jush of Perth and Blue Britches from a collection of Scots Reels or Country Dances.
Thank you.
some lovely tunes. I really have fallen off playing Bremner. I'm glad that this came up. I remember after first playing, I guess it's Aberdeen and Elgin, I recorded for the first time I talked about this book, and I remember thinking, man, I hope I revisit this. So it only took four years to get there, but it's nice to play some tunes again. We'll have to revisit more of Bremner later in the season, because there's lots of good music, good collection of stuff. All right, let's call it. This is going to be sort of a short episode, but a little peek behind the curtain. That's because I already recorded the next episode, which I thought was going to be this one, and then I realized, you know, I just need to put out this Robert Bremner treatise as its own episode, because I reference it too often. So this is going to be late, and need to just wrap it up and get it out. So we'll go out on one final hymn tune. This is another fairly cheery one. This is Dunferling. Next time on the episode, we'll do kind of the last of the big manifesto episodes, and then yeah, we'll get back into the swing of just recording bagpipe tunes and not so much talking. Anyway, thanks for listening. If you want to listen to the next episode, you already can. It was actually uploaded to Patreon before this episode was finished recording, so you can listen to the final draft, I think, and earlier drafts of all of these manifesto episodes over at patreon.com/waytotwog. It's a great way to support the show. You can also tell your friends about the show. I'd love to hear that. Yeah, thanks for listening. Don't forget, I want to hear from you this year. So if you've got a tune you've been working on, think about what tune you want to play on the podcast. In July, I'm hoping to have a listener-supported or listener contributed episode. And yeah, if you've got a historical music project underway and you think you could talk for 30 minutes to an hour and 20 minutes, and you want to have a whole podcast episode mixing in music and talking, I'd love to hear from you, and I'm definitely interested in hosting it. So thanks, everyone. See you in a couple weeks. Let's go out now to Dunfermline.